Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, parachute regiment soldier turned Fleet Street and homeless veterans photographer Stuart Griffiths. Also, All Smoke and Mirrors, the blogger on the Trump victory, that's Manfred Petrisch, speaking from Abkhazia on the eastern seaboard of the Black Sea. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, you can contact prsc.org.uk, that's the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. Also, Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or the national do-it.org. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
My name's Stuart Griffiths. I was a kid growing up in the 70s, and then my family relatives, you know, they were in the TA, they're in the regular army. My real father, his service wasn't in the armed forces, it was more in strange ways prison. So I think I had a little bit of resentfulness for that. But I was always, you know, an action man and stuff like that. You know, or the action man deserter one year, you know, when we couldn't afford. Where's the action man deserter? That's like a ye old trick of at Christmas for kids of the 70s. But there was that. And I think I started to really take it seriously when I was about 14 after I'd been run over. You know, I'd broke my femur, so I was in traction for about 5 months, and then I was on crutches for the rest for about another 6 months. And after that, I got into running and cycling, and I was falling back at school, and I was getting more and more aggressive. Obviously, you know, all that testosterone as a young teenager, and I wanted to direct it into some place. And there was always this sort of lingering thing. It was either the army or art school, which obviously two separate things entirely.
Why did you choose the army and not art school?
Because when I was at school, there was no chance I was even going to, you know, I wasn't even called back for my exams or anything. So I wasn't going to go to college. Or if I did go to college, it would be on the, you know, this special needs ticket sort of thing, which probably really didn't exist back then. And it was, you know, it was like, well, you know, go and work at a garden nursery. When I mentioned that, you know, I was thinking of joining up, I've had my tests. I said, okay, go and work an extended garden nursery, work experience. And that was it. This school just sort of let me go, never called me back for exams. And, you know, went and had my army test and, you know, went to Sutton Coalfield in Birmingham, passed the Paris selection process, which is a little bit tougher than everyone else because you had to do 15 pull-ups instead of 10, or, you know, 30 sit-ups instead of 10, or, you know, you had to run more times around the track and faster because, you know, you want to be an airborne infantryman. So after that, and to be turned around for someone, you know, some pen-pushing officer and say, you know, you have passed, well done, is a great thing for a 16-year-old. It gives him a sense of esteem, it gives him a sense of pride, and that's what I was really looking for. You know, it was I wanted to do the honourable thing. I wanted to serve my country and Queen. I wanted to be an airborne warrior. You know, that was it. You know, I was, you know, I remember the news footage from the Falklands War. I remember watching the Frank Hilton BBC documentary, The Paras, and being really kind of influenced. And I remember sat around my Auntie Jean's one Christmas, and my stepfather and my uncle, who was a ex-Cheshire regiment, my stepfather did national service in the Remy. They sat next to this, my cousin's mate, and he's just passed his training. I think he'd gone to one para. And they were like, and I just looked at that moment. I thought, look at the respect they're giving that guy. I want that respect myself. So when it came to deciding to join up, my stepfather said, you know, that's too hard. You don't want to do that. You don't want to join the paras. It's too tough. And of course, you're going to say, well, you, Dad. You. And I joined
up. A bit of reverse psychology.
Yeah. So and anyway, it made me even more determined. So that's why I joined, and I joined the Army Cadets to kind of condition my. You know, my grandfather was a drummer in the RAF band during the Second World War. That's about as much history in terms of the military that I know. So I don't come from a linear line of warriors from the First World War or any of that kind of rhetoric. You know, it just doesn't exist. You know, I think my granddad's father was an Irish tinker, you know. So in terms of this family tree, it stops at my grandfather in Carlisle, you know. Well, the training's really intense. They have this thing in the parachute regiment, or the parachute regiment, called P Company Selection, where you have like 10 days of very tough physical tests. It's called Test Week, and you if you pass P Company, you then earn the right to wear the coveted red beret on your head. And I did P Company when I was 17, and I was taken off because I just didn't have enough points. You know, I was a failure, so I knew what a failure meant. And I felt really I was like, oh God, you know, what am I going to do? I can't really go back up north and say I failed. I just didn't want to do that. So I then went to the retraining platoon, attempted P Company again, came off that with a serious groin strain. But I'd made some good friends. And so by the time I did P Company on the third time, where I thought, well, if I don't pass the selection process this time, I'm just going to knock it on the head, not bother with military life, and try art school, do that instead. At least I've had a go. I gave it 3 attempts. But anyway, on the third attempt, I passed. And then I was, you know, passed out, went to Free Parrot on the residential tour in Northern Ireland in November 89. The photography happened when I turned 18. On my 18th birthday, my stepfather, who was a keen amateur photographer, I mean, I always saw photography as something that the responsible member of the family would do. So my stepdad would take photographs at Christmas and all that kind of, you know, traditional family album, or what we now perceive as a family album. And he used to do all that. So he bought me this Instamatic camera, I think an Olympus Instamatic, or a Canon Sure Shot, I can't remember. He bought me this camera, and I had this camera, and I thought, oh, I bought a black and white roll of film, because I thought it'd look more warrior, you know, like warrior images are always in black and white. So I took a black and white roll of film, and it really started quite slowly at first. It was like pictures of myself, you know, stood by a helicopter, maybe some picture taken at night of you know, myself, you know, patrolling where nothing came out of the photograph whatsoever. And then I gradually started to just carry on with it. It was a kind of way of dealing with the boredom, and I just used to take photographs, not exactly for the sake of it, but in some way, you know, I thought, well, maybe these would be handy later on in my life, where I could use them as templates for drawings, because I was always the best drawer in the school. I was brought up on comic books, you know, Captain America, Mad Magazine, you know, all that sort of Marvel thing, and 2000 AD. You know, that was what I was brought up on. And so the cartoon drawing in the army was really became my identity. I became like, I wouldn't say the cartoon character, but once they found out I could draw pictures and cartoon drawings, I was always made to draw the section commanders, which I did. And I could get all the, you know, like, my section commander was from Wales, so I'm like, I did a picture of him, a caricature, with this sheep tied up with bunges as he's like shagging it, you know, going, oh boy, oh, and you know, and the platoon sergeant, you know, with his leg, because he attempted SAS selection and he failed, so he's like coming through this roof, like looking. So I used to think it was really hilarious, like, oh, look, these are really good, funny drawings, you know, but really I was taking the piss out of everyone. And and so that really, if you like, in my army career was a safety mechanism, because people thought I was a little bit wacky, a bit crazy, a bit of a joker, you know.
And you say dealing with the boredom. I mean, it must have been pretty dodgy too in Northern Ireland. It wasn't all safe, was it?
I'd say you interpret boredom in I reckon, the military boredom is probably very intense for a civilian person, but there's a lot of waiting around. There's a lot of, you know, you're waiting to go on a patrol, or, you know, if you're not on patrol and you're back at Palace Barracks, there's a lot of like cleaning, room jobs, this sort of, you know, if you need to be somewhere at a certain time, by the time it's gone through the chain of command, you're there 3 hours before anything, because it's always about timing, you know. But the timing thing means that you're just waiting around most of the time. There's a very famous saying in the army, was it hurry up and wait? You know, that's and they say that the waiting game is the soldier's enemy. but you do a lot of waiting around. I mean, like the Falklands War, for example, you know, the BBC announced that the Battle of Goose Green had happened when it hadn't happened. They were just waiting to go, and it was all about waiting for things. You say, if, you know, certain incident in Northern Ireland, you know, whoever in, you know, Whitehall or whatever, be waiting for that moment, and then, okay, go. You know, like in Bloody Sundays, right, go in now, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's always these decisions, but prior to that thing, that's probably why Paris would be seen as aggressive, because you sort of cooked up waiting for something, and then when you're sent, you're just like, whoa, you know what I mean? Because it's like being a kind of caged beast, you know.
So you left the army, and you got into photographing veterans. How did you do that?
Well, I wanted to be a war photographer after I left the army. You know, I read Unreasonable Behaviour by Don McCullen, thought, you know, this is what I want to do. You know, I started looking at Robert Capa photographs, you know, and all that kind of Vietnam thing, which we were very much brought up on that, you know, Apocalypse Now and all that sort of carry on. And I thought, yeah, I want to be a war photographer. I don't want a rifle. I just want to have a couple of Nikon cameras and go to these places of horror and photograph it and bring it back. And I don't think it was anything to do with this hero thing. I think it was because I was really interested in going to places and seeing why they were so weird. You know, I mean, Northern Ireland was surreal to me, because it was like, you know, when you do like a house raid, it was like raiding your grandma's home in, you know, Manchester or something. So that whole journey of yeah, and that's what I wanted to do. You know, I'd become a unit photographer in Free Para. And the reason I became a unit photographer in Free Para was because it's the only course that I actually applied for and got. And a lot of other guys didn't want to do the photographer's job, because they saw the photographer's job as being the puff's job. But I saw it's the most artistic thing the army could possibly offer me. I can't get a job as battalion cartoonist, but I can get a job as battalion photographer. So I became the battalion photographer. And it was on the Tyrone tour and that I was employed as, you know, an intelligence photographer working in the intel, which really, to begin with, was, you know, I was very disillusioned with it, because I spent most of the time hoovering the ops room and making cups of tea, you know, and reading books. I was reading William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. I mean, yeah. They say, what are you reading, Griff? I'm reading Naked Lunch. Should I read a passage? Like, weirdo you are, mate. So, yeah, so that's how I got into photography. And really, the photography was what I wanted to be a photojournalist.
After the army, you were photographing a lot of the veterans coming back from Iraq,
well,
Afghanistan, etc.
That didn't really happen until after university, when I started to work probably in 2000. So from 93 to the year 2000, I did a project at university. What was it called? I can't remember what it was. It was something where I'd photographed a few veterans, and I photographed my mate in his back garden with his pierced penis, you know, stood in his Red Devil bandana and his jumping boots, which was a very surreal image. I did a self-portrait of me with how I did my cam cream, because I used to wear camouflage cream like... who's the guy who did Schools Out? Alice Cooper. Yeah, Alice Cooper camouflage cream. You know, it started to kind of a little bit kind of begin around then at university, but I really wanted to become a photojournalist, so I remember doing the very first Falklands veterans. Well, the South Atlantic Medal Association meeting was an older shot, and there was Margaret Thatcher turned up, Jim Davidson turned up, and it was Samar 82 was formed. And I sold a picture to the Observer newspaper in London, and I thought, well, this is brilliant. And I was an intern at Magnum Photos at the time. You know, basically I was a glorified brew maker, you know, for all these full-on alpha male sort of types who, you know... That's all I can say. I applied, they never got in, so, you know. And I used the Magnum office, if you like, to kind of get some work with the International Red Cross, because they'd ring up the office and go, yeah, Stuart then. Stuart Franklin, who was like some Magnum, he got really irate. I was like, whatever. So I used the office really to sort of get this work. And then I went over to the Democratic Republic of Congo in July 1998, just before the Civil War kicked off. It took me about 3 weeks to get a photo permit. And I mean, this is all online. If you just type in, I was tied to a totem pole by Congolese soldiers, You'll see the Vice article. It'll explain the whole thing. But I was, like, put in prison, taken through mock executions, and that's probably where my real trauma... that was my traumatic moment, because I wasn't with a platoon, I wasn't with my section, I wasn't in the army, I wasn't, you know, I was on my own in Kinshasa, having to fight, you know, a gun. It was only because I know what a round sounds like going into a chamber that I actually realised I wasn't going to get my brains blown out all over the floor, you know. So that was my traumatic experience. And then I came back
from that. So were they actually trying to torture you or what?
Well, you're just kneeling down and, you know, you got your hands behind your head and they, like, pull the weapon and they're like, putting, you know, the rifle.
So what I'm trying to get at was, were they trying to get information out of you or just playing, having fun with you?
I think they were trying to see if I'd piss my pants. And it was intimidation. And full on, and then they accused me of being a Rwandan spy, and then they were trying to do me for espionage, and yeah, it was really paranoid, very paranoid.
How did you get out of that particular?
I got out of that by they raided my room at gunpoint, realised I wasn't, you know, like some kind of, you know, Reuters correspondent staying at the Intercontinental. I was staying at some real hotel, but it was only $5 a night, and they thought maybe this is not one of the top photojournalists. Look at the way he's living, you know. It was a pretty dreary, depressing room, you know, but good job I had my mozzie net with me. And I actually escaped with the Spanish ambassador. The British embassy was didn't do anything. They said, oh, yeah, we're 10 minutes behind you. Yeah, all right. I basically evacuated with the sisters, the missionaries, because I knew an electrician from Spain who stayed at the same hotel. He introduced me to the sister. I met the Spanish ambassador. He said, you can leave with us. So the Spanish are all right. I've got a lot to, you know, to thank for the Spanish. And also the Catholic Church, you know, the sister, she'd been out in Kinshasa for 32 years. I mean, what a woman, you know what I mean?
You then began getting into doing some Fleet Street photography. Yeah. How was that?
I started off as a paparazzi. That's when I was living at the homeless hostel. I started doing the paparazzi roundabout, you know, to fill the vacuum of when Diana, the people's princess, died. You know, and everyone hated the paparazzi, but there was a whole vacuum to fill. So, you know, like photographing Madonna or chasing Madonna around central London. You know, before them lights appeared on the lights, you know, the red lights. You could go through red lights, couldn't you, years ago? Not anymore. But so we used to do them sort of things and, you know, whatever it is Kate Moss was wearing that day. You know, she was always a... And it was like hunting season. So you'd go out and, you know, that's where I met my future wife and we worked together. And I liked the fact that she was doing it because, you know, the paparazzi, there are a lot of... you know, very misogynist, very sexist, like many kind of, you know, all men together, you know, like, look at my lens. And I just thought there were a lot of so I thought it was really great. My, you know, my wife, who then became my wife, Amanda, was working in this man's world, you know, and I worked with her and helped her get the exclusives. And we had 2 years of being like the kind of, the toast of, I don't know about the toast of Fleet Street, but our byline appeared everywhere in the tabloids. And when Amanda got pregnant, I started to work with the Associated Press because I wanted to do that serious. I wanted to be a serious photographer, you know, all that. Then I started to work for the Sunday Mirror on the investigations. And then the Iraq War kicked off. And I was waiting to go to Iraq with the Sunday Mirror. Terry Lloyd got killed. And it was like, right, Tina Weaver was the editor. We're not sending any more photographers out. And I was thinking, Jesus, you know, here was my lucky moment of becoming a war photographer, and I can't go. So I sent on another story, and I met a Sun journalist. And he said, oh, you know, well, you should come work for us. You know what I mean, ex-army and all that. So I started working at the Sun newspaper for about 2 years, and again never went anywhere. I think the nearest I got to anything military was doing a thing, you know, when Piers Morgan did that story about the so-called British soldier urinating over an Iraqi.
It got him sacked, I think.
Got him sacked. Well, I was working at the Sun. I said, this is a load of bullshit. For one, there's not four tonners out in Iraq. For two, the combat clip is too clean. But he hasn't got a strap on his rifle, all this. So the Sun did an article the next day, which obviously in the end, so I was actually pivotal in Piers Morgan.
You might have saved his job if you'd been in the Mirror.
Well, exactly, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, Piers, watch it. Yeah, exactly. I always saw Fleet Street as like a circle. The magazine was a slower circle, and the art world is an even slower circle, you know, and books are, Jesus, they're like an even slower. But I got the press cut-ins and stuff like that, and that's when I started returning to the hostel to do a thing in 2003, because I was so frustrated that I never got sent it anywhere. I thought, well, let's go back to the hostel and do some portraits of that, the homeless ex-serviceman story. No one's ever done that. And that's what I did. And then that was published in The Guardian in 2005. And, you know, people, I got on the radar and started to, you know, get work. And then with the veterans, the injured veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, that was a commission for GQ. They always send out the magazines to the newspapers before they go on the newsstands. Of course, all the tabloids had done their own version of my story, you know, the following week. And all these charities were sort of emerging and all this. And then I was, you know, got a bit of work with the Sunday Times magazine. And then the injured portraits, rather, were published in Vice. And then started a good working environment with Vice. I was kind of doing bits and pieces for them. 2011 was probably my biggest year with them, when I went back to Northern Ireland and I did a front cover story for them, and then went to Siberia photographing crocodile addicts, you know, like a moonshine version of heroin where your skin falls off. Nice. It was 2010 that I'd entered the Brighton Photo Fringe Open, which I was selected by Martin Parr, Val Williams and Charlotte Cotton as the supreme winner over all these other, you know. And I had a bit of exhibition, and it kind of, you know, it really got me on the platform, if you like. And but again, I thought, well, I'm being pigeonholed, this thing. And then when I exhibited the work, I showed Val all my sort of snapshots from the army, which had never been published before at all. I think there was maybe a photo 8 online thing years ago, but that wasn't really much. And he said, oh, these are really amazing. And then I applied for the National Media Museum bursary. And Greg Hobson, who was then the main guy there, saw the... Because the exhibition was split. It had all the portraits, and then it had the Northern Ireland archive in there, like a pink room where all the letters that I'd wrote were up on a wall, all the little frames of my snapshots, and a reading room. And it was to get people to stay in the gallery as long as possible, for them to sort of, you know, reflect on this person's work. And so I was given the bursary to make the first book, The Myth of the Airborne Warrior, which was great. But there was a lot of changes going on with the art world, the Arts Council, all these cuts, you know. What happened in 2010? Oh, yeah, the coalition. Yeah, Cameron and Clegg, sorry to swear. But it started to change the whole... I wasn't getting them GQ commissions anymore. The Vice thing was... Yeah, 2011 was the kind of high point. After that, that started to dwindle away because the guy who used to give me all the work then went to New York. And I was just like going, whoa! And I remember getting about £500 worth of jungle inoculations shot on my arm to do some kind of work out in Somalia or northern Nigeria for Vice, which never materialised. And I got in touch with some guys who made a film about me and said, look, you know, I've been working on this radio play, you know, which was Pig's Disco. And I then approached Ditto, who... quite interested in doing a book long before Photo Works. And I said, look, I like the Photo Works book, but it's got lines all over the text. I've got all this writing I've done. I'd really like this to be somehow put into something. He said, well, I still want to do a book with you, but yeah, you've got to write 20,000 words at least for us, because that's the kind of book idea we've got. So I submitted the Pig's Disco written piece. It was about 40,000 words, and he said, I love this, it's fantastic, the title's brilliant. And so we made Pig's Disco, and that was great. You know, I ended up on Libby Purvis's midweek programme, and the Mail Online did a piece about that, which was, you know, instantly shared 475 times on Facebook within 5 minutes. Probably not because they were like fans of the work, but because they knew me and said... And then all this sort of hate rhetoric started coming through, saying, you know, you traitor, you've let down the
the regiment, you know, how dare you mention drugs, blah blah, all this, you know we're gonna take you to court, blah blah blah, you know, you need to sort of apologize, all this sort, and it just went on and on and on.
I'm just thinking as well, because you're taking pictures of homeless veterans too, this kind of thing is not surely exactly what the Ministry of Defence, I mean, and you having worked for them, doing photographs for your own regiment, you know, this is not the kind of image they want to project of the army, is it?
Well, no, it's not the image, but it's the truthful image, and it's my journey. And I think I with Pigs Disco, I wanted the I wouldn't say the drug community, but then we were brought up on this whole rhetoric of work hard, play hard, and you know, it was the time of rave culture, and, you know, we wanted to get involved as well. That's what we did. We worked hard, we played harder, you know, and to sort of just denounce that we're all kind of, you know, forever on standby, hurry up and waiting. Is a load of nonsense, you know. We you know, I wanted to kind of express that, and Ditto, being a publishing company which deals with subcultures, saw the army as or the parachute regiment as, you know, a subculture, and I thought, well, this is brilliant, because, you know, this kind of, these people need to be represented in some sense. And also, I mean, Apocalypse Now and all them films that we watched, there's like loads of drug references. Do you know what I mean? It's. I don't know. I think it kind of goes hand in hand. When you start looking at, you know, narcotics in the military, you know, it goes back, you know, First World War, wasn't it? With the amphetamine sulfate and the crystal meth.
Do you think the Ministry of Defence are in denial about the drug side of things?
Well, I don't think they're in denial, but I just think there was like, whoa, because the Ministry of Defence even issued a comment on the Mail Online comments thing saying, look, whoa, this guy, it's been over 20 years he's been out, there was only small proportional guys that were doing that sort of thing, and now we've got random drug testing that's coming, which is true, it came in 96 after I was in. But, you know, I was that generation where, you know, we'd smoke pot and we'd burn incense sticks And, you know, that moment of taking LSD in Palace Barracks on Christmas 1990, that was a really intense experience, you know what I mean? It was my first time, and it was just like, whoa! You know, I think I was about 3 days out of it, you know what I mean? Thinking, Jesus, you know what I mean?
Was that in Northern Ireland?
I was in Belfast, yeah.
Right, because that, you know, that was a hot contest at the time,
well,
wasn't it?
That was after the Joyrider shooting. So in the cookhouse, you had the makeshift, you know, MDMF Vauxhall Astra, which A Company put up, you know, built by robots designed by scientists, stopped by A Company Free Para, with this dummy hanging out of all red ketchup all over it. And then Neil Kinnock comes and visits, doesn't he, with the press. And they're like having a field day going, Jesus, look. I mean, you know what I mean? But I was sat there tripping my nuts off in the cookhouse on Christmas Day, about 6 in the morning, going, wow, isn't that weird? So, yeah, but again, like Libby Purvis said, she said, well, what about the officers? You know, I said, well, what about the officers? We're not going to go up and go, sir, I don't feel well today, I'm soaring on acid. You know what I mean? You had to sort of kind of keep it a bit sort of shtum, you know, and that's where a lot of the fear in the writing comes from, because I really thought I was going to get caught out, put in prison, or, you know, just like whipped or whatever. You know, it's like, you I mean, imagine if catching a soldier in that state, if in an environment like that, it's, you know, beggars belief, isn't it? I mean, it's.
But what you were doing was reflecting what's going on in the real world outside.
We were reflecting, yeah, and yeah. There was a moment where I kind of felt, well, you know, I'm pigeonholed in this thing, you know. Many people in my former battalion, you know, especially my former rifle company and platoon, would never want to talk to me ever again. And I applied for a few things, and then I applied for this scholarship at the University of Ulster. I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose. You know, work was drying up with Vice. I didn't really know where I was going. I was kind of a real loose end. I had a retainer working for a national newspaper where I worked every Saturday, and that was my only source of income. And, you know, I had a wife and two children, you know, growing, a house in Hastings and three cats. And I just thought, I was getting into a bad place. I didn't really know where I was going, and so I applied for the scholarship, and then I was offered it, and it was basically
when I was offered that, I thought, well, that's the University of Ulster, Belfast. So I've gone back to Belfast, and they've given me this scholarship. Not Oxford or Cape, no, Belfast. And it took me a while, but my supervisors, Ken Grant and Paul Seawright, you know, great photographers, what they nurtured out of me was what I've been doing anyway, which is soldiers' snapshot photographs. And they said, look, just carry on with that. You know, just keep going on the road, keep on this journey, but find other people that were doing it as well and their narratives. You know, write it as a first-person thesis. Don't worry about this third-person thing. You are very much central to this story that you're writing. So, and he said, you know, look at the new journalism. Tom Wolfe, Hunter Thompson. You know, just keep going. And so really that's, for me, it was like kind of going back to that. You know, I want to distance myself a little bit from the veterans thing, but then it was like, oh, I'm going back into it. And I think one of the reasons why I wanted to distance was because of the animosity. And that animosity was one of the reasons why I joined Veterans for Peace, because, you know, I spent so much time, and obviously I was known for the injured veterans, the books that I've done. And I thought, well, you know, this is my beat, you know what I mean, the whole veteran thing. I've got to carry it on.
Look, there's another thing here, and that is that, of course, you're going back to a very different Northern Ireland, aren't you?
Well, this is it. I mean, Northern Ireland is completely changed. It's a fantastic city, and I feel so kind of humbled by the fact of, like, being given a scholarship in this day and age with all these brutal cuts, this whole weird educational system where, you know, young children have got to, like, do bloody tests every week, that I've been given this opportunity. And this is the thing which, you know, I may have been institutionalised in the army, but I then joined another great institution, which was the Institution of Knowledge and Education at the University of Brighton, you know, and now I'm doing this at the University of Ulster. So, you know, and that it's always been the academics and then people that have always urged me to carry on. And you know, and that's been really important, because if I hadn't had that, I wouldn't have been as truthful as I am, and I would have just sort of said, oh, you know, I would have what they called in the army, screwed the nut for myself, which is never break the soldier's trust, which that's how they see it. You know, when I wrote about Pigs Disco, I remember a guy on Facebook who joined the police force. He says, hey, what happened in the Pigs Disco stays in the Pigs Disco. I was just like, that, man, that's my best prose I've ever written, you know. So, but I knew then it was going to get weird.
But you've also been on a journey through Fleet Street, an interesting place. Yeah. I mean, although Fleet Street doesn't itself really exist anymore, you were taking photographs. What did you think of the quality of the words that appeared on those same pages?
I've got a lot of respect for the journalists, you know, even the Red Tops, because you've got to grab the attention straight away. It's you know, I mean, a lot of it is, and this is where I see the sort of the strangeness of Fleet Street, because it's all about editors colluding with each other, you know. Or what are you going to put on your front page? What are you going to do this? What are you going to do that? I mean, even the News of the World, I mean, you know, they were just turning people over. That was their thing. The screws are here. And they were called the screws, really, for a reason, which was to screw people. But they generated a lot of work. Back in the day, because it was like, well, I'm on a doorstep. Oh. Is anyone there? Yeah, the screws are still here. Well, better put you on a double, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it was a time and place where, you know, I got a mortgage, you know, and all that, and you know, it was great. I mean, it was really hideously boring work, but it was. And some of the reporters I worked with, you know, some good colleagues. I mean, there was moments where I just thought, you know, this is utter garbage, you know. And a lot of it was because it was these shagging stories. And like I say, I wanted to be a war photographer back then. I mean, I don't want to know. I mean, I think the war photography thing slowly dwindled away when I was going to go to Afghanistan for GQ magazine, and then they sent David Bailey instead. That was hilarious. And these pictures are...
Okay, could you just run through some of the books that you've done, you know, things that people can check you out online and that kind of stuff?
The two books I've done is Myth of the Airborne Warrior, that was published by PhotoWorks in 2011. Pigs Disco, which is published by Ditto Press, that was published in 2013. I've got a website, stuartgriffiths.net. That's
you know, a lot of stuff I've done for Vice as well. I mean, if you go into, if you type Stuart Griffiths Vice, there's ample research on there for scholars.
And have you got any tips for youngsters or even middle-aged people thinking of taking up photography professionally? Any tips?
I have, yeah. Read more philosophy.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Manfred Petrich. I go under the name of Freeman, and I have a political blog, alternative news blog for the German-speaking world called Alle Schall und Rauch. What do I think of the Trump election? Well, in a way, I think it is a miracle because everything was against Donald Trump. The Wall Street was against him. The complete media was against him. The establishment was against him in Washington. Even their own political party was against him. So he was completely alone.
Hang on. How can you say the Republican Party was against him? He was a Republican candidate.
Well, we know that in his own party, the Speaker of the Republican dumped him and said he's not going to support him. And by the way, he's crawled back again now. But during the campaign, many from the Republican side were not supporting him, not going to his election campaigns, and also financially they were not supporting him. So he had everybody against him, more or less, except a few internet alternative news sites and, of course, the mass of the people which showed with the election.
Now, what does this tell us about the liberal elite? Because we hear this word liberal elite. What does it mean to you?
The liberal elite is kind of what we in the German-speaking world call the left fascists, which is in a way a contradiction, but they're leftist fascists. We are trying to tell us what we have to think and what we have to do and who we have to elect, and with political correctness. You know, you're not allowed to say things anymore since a long time. And what has happened is that they live in their own bubble. They have no connection to the real world and to the people on the street, the working class, so to say. And therefore, they created this world where they believed that Hillary Clinton will win with a huge majority. They believed this. They were already, I mean, look at the media. They were already printing magazine covers with Madam President. They were already doing videos where they announced her election and everything. And then came the big surprise and the big shock.
Okay, what about the media? What does this mean for them, though? Because they certainly did make a big fuss about Hillary Clinton. There seemed to be quite a lot of bias here in Britain. I'm not quite sure what they thought the point of it was, since the British people couldn't vote. But the BBC was actually one of the last broadcasters in the world, if not the last, to say that Clinton was still in with a chance at 4 o'clock in the morning here. They were saying, oh, well, Hillary can still do it. She can still do it, while the rest of the world had admitted, well, she's lost.
Yes, the media, I mean, I watched the whole election night and until 7 o'clock in the morning, our time in Central Europe, and I saw how the faces of the moderators who were doing the election coverage were getting whiter and whiter every time a new state turned red for Trump. They just couldn't believe it. Their mouths were standing open, and they were trying to use You know, they were still saying, oh, well, as you just said, Clinton will still make it and so forth. But then at 6 o'clock in the morning, that was 2 o'clock in New York, it was definite that Trump had won. And then Podesta came on stage at the Democratic Election Party and announced that Hillary will not come and that they will, you know, that they all should go home and sleep. And then we heard that Hillary had phoned Trump and congratulated him to the election. And only then did most of the media stop saying that Hillary could win. Only then, when they heard that Hillary herself had given up. And it was just incredible how one-sided everything was. And what has happened now is that the New York Times, the owner of the New York Times, Schlumberger, has had to write a letter to all his subscribers and readers and apologize, more or less, for the very bad one-sided coverage of the whole election process and the campaign. And he promised to do it better in the future.
And just a week beforehand, he was saying, predicting this massive landslide for Hillary Clinton. Yeah. I think 87% for Clinton, 13% for Trump. And yet the real result was the opposite. I mean,
exactly. So they were so off the scale, you know, of reality. And that shows their bias, which they had all the time. And they were not in touch with what the real people are thinking. And this is something we already saw when the Brexit was done, when they were asking people in before the Brexit what they want to vote. And also there, the predictions were completely wrong. Even on the day of the election, they were wrong. And what that shows me is that this whole media industry and also this whole polling industry is completely in a different planet. They're not here. They're not listening to the people.
What about relations between Russia and Germany and Russia and Europe generally? Because, of course, there's quite a lot of tension still around Eastern Europe.
Well, what has happened, of course, is that it's really funny. The telephone conversation last Monday between Trump and Putin has caused the people in here in Europe, in Germany, in Paris, especially in Brussels. I mean, they're getting heart attacks. They're completely in panic because, you see, their whole career has been built up on a Russophobe, hate. Now, and now this is being pulled away under them, and they are just standing there stupefied. They don't understand what's going on, because suddenly the new elected president wants to have a good relationship with Moscow, and he also did a conversation with Xi in Peking, so also with the Chinese. So they don't understand their world anymore. It's the rug has been pulled out under them.
Well, John Pilger is a British filmmaker. Well, he's actually Australian, but he made films here in Britain for many years. He's got a film coming out the 6th of December, being shown on ITV network here in Britain and that Tuesday, and I think it's going to be on cinemas a few days beforehand, etc. Now, he's saying that there could be a coming war on China. I think that's the name of the film, The Coming War on China. And he's convinced that actually the president may not be able to stop it, because the arms companies, the Pentagon, the Council on Foreign Relations, what you might call the permanent government, want this war to happen.
You mean Trump can't stop it?
Yeah. Can he stop it? That's the question I'm asking you. Can he stop it?
Well, beginning from the 80s, I worked a lot on Wall Street, and I was living also a while in New York. And at that time, I kind of found out about Trump. And since then, I've always watched him, what he has done. And I remember in 87, when he brought out his book, The Art of the Deal, which was a bestseller. I bought this book because I was interested from a business point of view, why he's so successful and things like that. So I've been watching him a long time. And I know, first of all, that he is really a businessman who does what he says, and he has he has done a lot of things. He's done a lot of constructions. He's employed a lot of people. He has given a lot of jobs to people and things like that, which is completely contrary to all these politicians, like also Hillary Clinton, because her career is only made out of destruction.
Okay, yeah, but Trump has only done that because he's got a good, cozy relationship with the banks that give him the money to employ people. I mean, yeah, surely he's just a tool of the bankers, is he?
Yeah, but that's everybody who is in the construction and in the building business has to have a good relation with banks, because banks are the ones who give you the money to do the building. You know, I mean, if you can you buy a house 100% with cash? No, you have to go and get a mortgage. So that's a normal thing for everybody who has to do something with building.
So what I'm saying is, surely he's just a kind of operator, you know, for the bankers. If he's got that relationship, is he really in charge? Can he really say, no, we're not going to have this war? Or can he tell the bankers what to do?
Well, it depends. You see, since the election, there is a new website which has been opened up where they are looking for 4,000 people used for the new administration. 1,000 of those have to be then confirmed by the Senate, and 3,000 can be selected directly by the Trump team. So there are 4,000 people who are coming in new, which will replace all the ones from Obama. So what that means is that if he gets the right people in who replace all the old school, and he can then have a good team around him, he will be able to then push through his new policies and new ideas. Of course, there is a huge amount in this whole government pyramid. There are a lot of government workers who, of course, stay. And that's the big problem. Actually, you would have to replace nearly everybody if you want to do your own thing. All right? That means, on the one hand, there will be opposition to what he wants to do, but if he's got the right people around him, he will be able to change a lot of things and maybe also stop this idea about a war with China, which is completely stupid. And don't forget this, that his granddaughter, there is a video where she is speaking perfect Mandarin. And this video has now gone totally viral in China. That means his granddaughter is actually the best ambassador for him in China now. And the reason why the granddaughter speaks Mandarin Chinese, she's only 5 years old, is because her nanny is a Chinese and she taught her that. So that shows, because her mother Ivanka put this on the internet, that they want a good relationship with China. They just want to have it on a fair, even playing field. That's what actually he wants.
What do you see over the next couple of years? I mean, how do you see this developing? And, you know, bearing in mind, of course, that we've got this financial cliff edge, someone is going to have to deal with it, which we could fall over almost at any time.
Yes, the big problem is, of course, that because of the opposition, you see, the elite is at the moment in total shock, and they are now, there was a gathering organized by George Soros in Washington of all the enemies of Trump to find a way how to oppose him. So what can happen is that the Fed will increase now the interest rate. And that means, of course, a huge problem for everybody, especially also for Trump, because he's now he's now getting a huge $20 trillion debt from Obama. And that means that, I mean, first of all, you can't repay it, of course. And the second thing is, if the Fed increases the rate, then also the interest will be huge. And this will be a worldwide effect, which means also that in Europe, with the euro, the interest rates would go up, which means also all those countries and companies and private people who are up to their head in debt will have a problem with increased interest rates. I mean, that can happen. I mean, the other thing is, of course, that the warmongers, I mean, don't forget that Hillary Clinton wanted to push through a no-fly zone in Syria, which would have meant immediate confrontation with Russia, and that would have led to a war. And I think that with this conversation with Putin, where they have agreed that they want to fight the terrorists, ISIS, together, and that Trump wants to stop supplying weapons to the terrorists, that we could have in a few months there, a real chance of peace if America and Russia get together.
What about relations with Saudi Arabia, though? Because that could be a bit more rocky, couldn't it?
Yes, and already under Obama, there has been, kind of a strained relationship with Saudi Arabia, because in America there is this energy independence drive. That means they don't need the oil from Saudi Arabia anymore, and Trump will push this more. And that means that also that Trump could finally say, we have to stop the Saudis and the Qataris to finance the terrorists, and we are going to punish them now. I mean, I hope that happens, because it's impossible that the Saudis and Qataris are financing all the terrorists, right? I mean, where's the money coming from them?
Yeah. Also, the tension over the 9/11 report, because Trump is on the record as actually saying that he believes that the Twin Towers were brought down by explosives. I mean, this is not the official story, is it?
No, I mean, that could be that also once he's in power from the 21st of January on, that he will also do a new investigation there and kind of find out what really happened. I mean, this could also be, which would be a huge revolution and upset for the establishment. Yeah, I mean, if I were Trump, I would really surround myself with good bodyguards, because he's definitely in danger.
There's also the very strong possibility that when the Article 50 letter goes in from Theresa May, beginning of next year, in March, she says, to Brussels, that the financial elite around the world will punish Britain. In fact, the indications are from Vince Cable, who was the business secretary in the last government and also the chief economist for Shell Oil before that, as well as Alistair Campbell, who was the communications director for Tony Blair, they're both of them saying, oh, well, you know, there's going to be a kind of financial tsunami next March when the exit from the European Union is triggered by the British government. I mean, what do you make of that? Is that possible? Yeah, and if so, what will happen?
But where is the financial elite centered? It's centered in the City of London. So why would they punish themselves? The City of London is the center of all financial business, more or less, in the world, even more important than Wall Street. So I don't know why. Who else is there around, you know?
What about Deutsche Bank? People like this, they're quite powerful people.
Yeah, but Deutsche Bank is a coma patient who is just lying there and nearly dead. I mean, Deutsche Bank is completely, they're bust. I mean, they're just 5 minutes before bankruptcy.
Okay. All right. So, do you think, generally speaking, it's made much difference, this Trump victory? And you know, and how would you see it fits in with Brexit? And what's your crystal ball predictions for the next year or so?
Well, I think that Brexit, and now more so even the Trump win, will push and give all those other exits and all those other drives for independence and exit from EU a lot of motivation. And we will see this in all those coming elections next year, like in Germany, there will be the general election. And by the way, Merkel has today announced that she wants to go for a fourth term. I mean, how long does she want to be there? It's incredible. And so she announced her candidacy next year for the chancellery. I mean, it's just unbelievable, but she will really get punished. Everybody who is now against the normal people and for the elites will get punished. And this will be a worldwide phenomenon everywhere. And because what happens in America is always a leading indicator for everything else that happens around the world. So what I can say is that the future let's put it this way: if Hillary would have won, then you might as well shoot yourself, kind of, because I mean that would have been definitely war. And with Trump, I think and I hope, as far as I can judge him, we will have peace, because he is more or less now interested in his number one priority, and that is making America great again. And that means he has to clean up the mess and repair all the damage which is in America itself.
But so how can he deal with the debt? This is inheritance that he's taken from Obama and from previous administrations. How can he deal with that, whatever it is, $20 trillion of debt?
Either he continues like they do. I mean, they just keep. Well, what he wants to do, first of all, he wants to stop all this overspending. That means that America needs $2 or $3 billion dollars a day just to run the shop. I mean, he wants, for instance, to reduce all the military expenditure like NATO. I mean, he's already said he's not prepared to pay 70% of the NATO costs. And this that means he has to reduce all these spendings to be able to live with what the government earns through taxes. And on the other hand, he has to find ways how to repay this. Or what he can do is make a huge inflation and then what we call a reset of the currency, you know? I mean, he can do that.
Will you be applying for a job as one of Trump's advisors?
No, I don't have. The only job that would interest me is be the Trump of Europe. That would interest me, that job.
Okay. Manfred, where do people find you online?
Well, as I said, if you type in the name Alles, A-L-L-E-S, Schall, S-C-H-A-L-L, und, U-N-D, Rauch, R-A-U-C-H, which means more or less like the German, it means in German what in English is, it's all smoke and mirrors.
Okay, Manfred Petrisch, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for this week, Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Parachute Regiment soldier turned Fleet Street photographer Stuart Griffiths, also Manfred Petrisch, All Smoke and Mirrors blogger from Austria. He was born, but he's now in Abkhazia on the Black Sea. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street.
on 0117 909 6897. Also, Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the national volunteering site, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.